Hello and welcome to The Europeans, the show that keeps you up to date with a broad selection of very important and occasionally not so important and silly stories from across this diverse continent of Europe. My name is Dominic Kramer. I'm in Amsterdam, back from holiday.
Yay!
And that voice you hear is Katie Lee, my co-host in Paris. Hi, Katie. How's it been?
Hi. Good. Although, I just want to check, am I actually talking to the real Dominic? Because last week, while you were away, we heard an AI version of you. So I just want to check that you're actually human.
That was really freaky. I think you can tell it's me because I don't have that like strangely Australian twinge that somehow AI gave my accent.
I liked it. It was a more exotic version of the Dominic that we know and love.
It certainly was. But no, this is me for real. Although it's weird. Like there's no way I could really prove it, right?
There's no way. I can't see you. I can just hear you and you could well be a robot.
Maybe Wojciech has like locked me out forever and from now on no one's gonna know.
But you've been on holiday for 2 weeks.
I have.
Was it lovely and refreshing?
It was. Refreshing's a good word for it because it was quite cold. We decided to go on a summer holiday to the Scottish Highlands and it is really one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to. It's like a fantasy land. And we knew the weather could be bad, but it really was worse than we even expected. It was raining almost every day and it was about 11, 12 degrees.
Living inside a Scottish cliche.
Well, it's even worse than the cliche. Like there were news reports. Why is this summer in Scotland even worse than normal this year? But I guess at least we weren't in a heat wave because that's the alternative. And in a way, I think it's easier to deal with a lot of rain than 45 degrees.
Well, we're very glad to have you back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back. And it's been quite a week, hasn't it?
I'm still processing. What an insane week to be a dual French-British national. I feel like I'm dreaming.
Yeah, suddenly your countries are both like a bit left-wing.
It's very strange.
Who would have thought?
And it feels extra surreal because I've been able to experience both brand new Britain and brand new France in recent days because I was in the UK this weekend visiting family. I don't know what I was expecting, but post-election England looks exactly like pre-election England in that it was just full of people buying sandwiches from Pret-a-Manger. And I can't say that post-election France looks very different either, but they are both potentially going to be, yeah, quite different now. And it's kind of exciting and scary. You guys have a word for that in the Netherlands, don't you?
Spannend. Yeah, it's also been pretty exciting here in the Netherlands, actually. We also had a new government last week that finally sat down. So yeah, it's all change everywhere. And we are going to talk about the UK election in good week, bad week. But later on the show, we're going to interview Katie.
Ta-da!
About the French election. I had an episode of Katie while I was away on another podcast and she was so good at analysing and explaining what's going on. So, hey, thanks, Katie, for agreeing to be a guest on our show too. I have a lot of questions.
Oh, great. Can't wait.
First, though, of course, it is time to find out who's getting good week and who's getting bad week. Good week.
Bad week. Who's had a good week, Dominic?
It's been a very good week for the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. If you're listening to this podcast, you possibly, probably heard that after 14 years of Conservative rule in the UK, the Labour Party won a landslide election last week, giving the new Prime Minister Keir Starmer a stonking majority of 174 seats.
Stonking, there's a word that we don't hear enough.
Did you realise, Katie, that this is the first time in our adult lives that a party other than the Conservative Party have won an election in the UK?
Yeah, it's quite crazy because I think the last Labour government is my kind of first political memory, but I hadn't quite appreciated that that was when I was an actual child.
Yeah, and that it wouldn't happen for a very long time again. So yeah, 2005 was the last time Labour Party won an election in the UK, and this election broke a lot of records for Keir Starmer. It's the largest majority government in the UK in 25 years. It almost matches Labour's largest majority, which was in 1997 under Tony Blair's leadership. And for Rishi Sunak's Conservatives, it was the worst defeat in the history of his party. There was one record, though, that Keir Starmer won't be so happy about. Labour managed to get a majority in Parliament with the smallest share of the popular vote nationally for any majority government in UK history. Mm. They actually only won 33.7% of the national vote share, but still have a huge majority thanks to this constituency-based UK electoral system, first past the post, where you vote for an individual MP in your local area. But that's what matters in this system, is the constituency seats that work out whether or not you can form a government. And Labour was incredibly efficient with securing their votes. So Keir Starmer will be a happy man this week, settling into his new home in number 10 Downing Street. And also probably very sleep deprived, I'd imagine. Like, who would want this job? I still don't understand it.
It's a terrible job.
Right. I get tired enough making a podcast, let alone running a country.
And it's not like Keir Starmer's approval ratings are exactly sky high as he enters Downing Street, are they?
No, they are not. A lot of the analysis about this election has painted these results as a rejection of the Conservative Party more than a ringing endorsement of the Labour Party. Keir Starmer is a lot more popular than his Conservative rival, Rishi Sunak, but he is actually really disliked by a lot of people on the left, which is maybe surprising for the leader of a Social Democratic Party. Many on the left accuse him of squashing the left-wing elements of his party and that the platform he ran on is not as different as they would like it to be to what the Conservatives have been offering. Mm. And whilst I'm sure he'd deny that, he sees himself as forming a government of change. I think he probably would admit himself that he did run a pretty cautious campaign. He was trying not to promise too much and making it clear that Labour are not going to be turning the money taps on when they come into power. He has said that they will not raise taxes for working people, for example, something that will mean he doesn't have much room to increase public spending. And many people argue that that is very necessary in the UK. Speak to pretty much anyone that's British, and they will tell you that the state of public services, such as the National Health Service, is dire.
Yep.
Anyway, there's so much to talk about in this election. I could talk about it for hours, but I thought maybe it would be interesting to talk a bit about how it hasn't only been a good week for the Labour Party, but that it could potentially also be a good week for the UK's relationship with the EU now that a more pro-European party have come into power.
Because it has been clear from this campaign that Labour are more pro-European than the Conservatives, but they didn't exactly go into this campaign like waving the European flag and saying, oh, we're going to rejoin the EU. Brexit has been cancelled. They didn't say anything like that, did they?
No, they did not. Brexit being cancelled is definitely not on the table for now. Keir actually said in the final days of the election campaign last week that he didn't think that the UK would rejoin the EU, the customs union, or the single market in his lifetime. So if you're someone who wants the UK to rejoin the EU, don't get your hopes up.
He did say in his lifetime, though, and he is a man with grey hair. Like, this is a very morbid question, but is there any chance that it might be sooner than we think? I can't believe I'm asking that.
He's 61 years old, so he thinks that won't happen for quite some time, assuming he's planning on living for another few decades. And he is still out there playing football, so I think he's still quite fit. I don't think he's going to die soon. Why am I speculating about when he's going to die?
I mean, this is kind of the mood of the moment, though. Like, if you look at the election across the Atlantic, I think the US has got us thinking about the mortality of all of our leaders at the moment.
Yeah, you're right. Let's not talk about that anymore. Mm-hmm. Anyway, his lack of ambition is probably because Brexit and the UK's relationship with the EU is still a pretty toxic topic in the UK. It divided the country so badly that I think a lot of politicians just want to run a mile from the topic and like not talk about it much. Starmer managed to win by securing a pretty broad coalition of voters, and that includes quite a lot of people who voted for the UK to leave the EU in the Brexit referendum all those years ago. So he's not going to want to upset those people, although, of course, a proportion of those people might now not vote to leave if the election was held today, having realised what leaving the EU has done to the UK.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a portion of them are going to be dead soon. It's going back to death again. This is a very disturbing podcast this week.
That's also probably true. But I was meant to be framing this as potentially good news for the EU's relationship with the UK.
Yes.
And there are a few possibilities on the cards. One of the big things that the Labour Party promised in its manifesto was that it would seek a veterinary agreement. I can never say that word. Is that it would seek a veterinary agreement with the EU.
Veterinary. Is that animals?
Veterinary.
It's a word I never hear said out loud. I just see it written down. So to do with vets and animals.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's about products of animal origin, so mainly agro food goods. And the idea is that if the UK and the EU were aligned on this, if they followed the same sets of rules around veterinary regulations and the health and welfare of animals, then fewer checks would be required, which would, in theory, increase trade between the UK and the EU and help bring down the cost of food in the UK. Mm-hmm. Of course, it might not be plain sailing. It would also probably require the UK to accept a role for the European Court of Justice. But there seems to be optimism about this plan, at least in the UK, where a recent study suggested a deal could boost agri-food exports by 22%. And all major UK trade groups are calling for a deal to be done. And this week, the Irish Taoiseach, Simon Harris, was speaking to Sky News and said that, in his view, there is space for an agreement with the UK.
Okay, so that's a start. Presumably that's not it, though.
No, there are other things. There's mention in the Labour manifesto of making touring for artists between the EU and the UK easier, something that is very close to my heart as a musician myself. It's been...
Yeah, you've talked about this before.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a disaster for musicians living in Britain who used to work regularly in the EU. So that will be a relief if that happens. The European Commission are hoping to open discussions with the UK government also about your youth mobility agreement, the one that you discussed, Katie, on this show a bit earlier in the year.
Oh, yeah.
Something that was shot down by Rishi Sunak's government, but the EU are hoping they might have a bit more luck with Keir Starmer. But one of the biggest things is this new UK-EU security pact that Labour would like to achieve. They said in their manifesto that they want to, quote, rebuild relationships with key European allies, including France and Germany, through increased defence and security cooperation.
Hmm.
That might not sound incredibly exciting, but when I started looking into this, it's actually a broader plan than I would have thought. They want it to include defence, energy, the climate crisis, investment strategies, cybercrime, pandemics, and also illegal migration.
Wow, quite a long list.
It is. And David Lammy, the new Foreign Secretary, has immediately begun work on strengthening those relationships and talking about this plan. In what was essentially his first full day in the job last Saturday, he took a whistle-stop tour of Europe, flying around the continent to meet foreign ministers in Germany, Poland, and Sweden. He probably would have visited France as well if it wasn't for the small matter of an election.
We've been busy.
Wouldn't have been a good moment to be like, hey guys, I'm the new British Foreign Secretary.
Anybody got time for coffee? I guess it's good for his carbon footprint that he didn't stop here, because that already sounds not great for the environment. If very good for Britain's relationships with various governments.
Yeah, stop flying, David Lammy. He is definitely making noises to suggest he wants the UK to be a better friend to the EU than it has been in recent years. He also apparently did quite a lot of diplomacy in the run-up to the election already. So he's been like trying to get a bit of a head start. He invested a lot of time in building relationships with top figures in the French political establishment, for example, some of whom I guess now might be losing their jobs depending on how the cookie crumbles. He's been tweeting in different languages, and he's been interviewed in other magazines in different languages. Like, he was in this French geopolitical journal called Le Grand Continent. Do you read it, Katie?
I do know it. They make some good stuff, yeah.
But I guess this is all part of a strategy to strengthen connections outside the Anglophone bubble. So I think it is quite a change for the EU now having a partner who is like so open to them in the UK, even if it's not as open as some would like.
Hmm.
But it is weird to think that if the UK was still in the EU, Keir Starmer would probably have been incredibly powerful, what with incredibly weakened Emmanuel Macron and a very unloved German leader. In another world, Starmer could have been one of the most influential voices in Europe But he's not.
Well, he could still be one of the most vocal leaders in continental Europe.
That's
Let's
true.
Not get EU borders get in the way of things. I'm very interested to see what he does on the European stage.
Yeah, I am too. Anyway, good week for Keir Starmer and for the relationship between the UK and the EU.
Yay.
Who's had a bad week?
It has been a bad week for tourists in Barcelona. Did you see this footage of tourists being shot with water pistols by anti-tourism protesters?
Now I did, yes, on Instagram. And I feel a bit mixed about it.
Yeah.
I thought it was like, on first impression, I thought, oh, that's funny. And then I thought, no, that's actually horrible.
Yeah, I mean, some of the tourists getting fired at with these water guns were kind of laughing about it. Others looked really quite uncomfortable. On an individual level, this is quite aggressive.
Yeah.
The water pistol thing was part of a larger anti-tourism protest over the weekend by thousands of Barcelona residents, at which people shouted, "Tourists go home," at people they identified as tourists, some of whom responded by photographing the protesters, which feels rather ironic. They're like, "Oh, what an interesting local sight." The protesters also taped up the entrances to some hotels and threw bottles into the lobby. And yeah, they shot at some tourists at cafes with water pistols, forcing them to take refuge inside. And you might say, you know, oh, this is just a mother and her kids who are visiting from Italy or Germany or wherever. They're just trying to have a coffee. They're bringing money to a local business. They could very well be respectful tourists who are enthusiastic about discovering the culture of Barcelona.
Yeah.
Do they really deserve to be fired at with water guns and targeted in this actually quite unpleasant way just for doing that? So I felt a bit unsure, like you, watching this about whether this action was justified. But I also really wanted to understand where it was coming from and why the anger against tourists in Barcelona has reached what feels like a boiling point.
I'm just not sure that targeting individual tourists is the way to go.
Right.
I mean, there are obviously policies that can manage the number of tourists in a city. For example, I saw a couple of weeks ago that Barcelona has now banned Airbnb completely, right?
What, yeah.
Is there a link between these protests over the weekend and that move by the city?
Yeah, so the Airbnb move that you saw, that is the strictest policy on Airbnb in Barcelona so far. But there have been previous attempts to restrain its takeover of the city for years already. And you can definitely see these protests over the weekend as part of the same overarching story. And that story is the crazy cost of housing in Barcelona, in large part because of over-tourism, although not entirely. You know, as we know, rents are crazy in a lot of European cities at the moment, and there are multiple factors involved. There's a shortage of supply, there are situations where rent controls would be helpful but are getting ruled out for political reasons, there's a failure to stop large investment companies from buying up huge swathes of housing. But housing is a big part of why people from Barcelona have been getting increasingly resentful of tourists. It is the most expensive city in Spain to live in, and the rent increases over the past year have been particularly eye-watering. According to Idealista, which is Spain's biggest property listing website, rents per square meter went up 14% in the year up to April. And it's become increasingly difficult for people who are actually from the city to find a place to live there. You know, young people especially are having to live with their parents for longer because if you're on a starting salary and maybe your first job, there's no way you can afford to get your own place.
In this series we made about Oatly last year, we talked about how the Barcelona housing market got really messed up during the financial crisis about 15 years ago. What has that got to do with the situation around housing today?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I asked our producer, Kat Slazlo, about this. She actually grew up in Barcelona. And she said that during the financial crisis, a lot of people in Barcelona were dealing with these insane mortgage payments. There were all of these government bailouts for banks that didn't seem to be helping normal people struggling through this all that much. And so a lot of people at the time felt that renting out their places via Airbnb for short stints was one of the only ways that they could keep their homes. There were also a bunch of investment companies buying up homes that people didn't manage to keep and turning them into year-round short-term rentals. So the financial crisis is really something that helps create these kind of knock-on tensions. And in terms of what's going to happen now in Barcelona with Airbnb, it's not like all Airbnbs in the city will immediately stop being rentable to tourists. The city authority is going to stop giving out new licenses for all short-term lets, and they're not going to renew the existing ones. So it means that by 2029, there won't be any Airbnb-type rentals in the city if this policy holds. So it's not immediate, it's quite gradual, but it's actually a pretty radical policy.
I find it sad that Airbnb has become this like symbol of raising house prices all across the world. Because I thought like the original idea of it was actually quite charming. The idea that like if you had a spare room, someone could come and stay, you could make a bit of extra cash to help cover your rent. But it's just very rare that that's what happens now. It's like so many people buying properties specifically to rent out on Airbnb.
And then filling them with the same generic art.
Exactly.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Somebody fix Airbnb's art. That's the biggest part of this problem.
But what's the reaction been like in Barcelona to this new policy?
I haven't seen too many official responses from like activist groups. But for people who want to increase the supply of housing available for locals, this is presumably a really good thing. Like this policy will supposedly make 10,000 extra homes available. But Kat said that the dynamics at play here are complex and they're quite a bit more long-term than this. A lot of people who've used Airbnb in recent years to help ends meet in Barcelona, they've actually been quite pissed off by previous efforts in recent years to restrict short-term lets in the city and being deprived of that income. She says it's also important to note that Spain went into the financial crisis with pretty high home ownership rates. And it still does have higher rates of home ownership, in fact, than a lot of other European countries. So it's not like the only people who've been making money from Airbnb in recent years have been like gazillionaires or even necessarily upper middle class people. In a lot of cases, it's normal people we're talking about.
Clearly, Airbnb and housing is a big part of what's fueling this anti-tourism movement in Barcelona. But is it just about housing, or has over-tourism affected the city in other ways that are grating on people?
Yeah, it's a few different things, although housing is definitely a big one. At these protests over the weekend, people also shouted slogans about neighborhoods getting homogenized and losing their identity, because increasingly they all have to have the same kind of amenities and attractions and restaurants for tourists. It's also about the effects that becoming overrun by tourists have had on the economy. You know, tourism does bring money to businesses like restaurants and hotels, obviously. But it also makes the prices of everyday goods more expensive and creates lots of incentives to open, for example, a souvenir shop as opposed to something that might be useful for local people. And even if it does generate income and jobs in the tourism sector, it also creates costs. So there's a tourist tax in Barcelona of €3.25 a night for people coming to stay in the city. That tax currently generates an income for City Hall of about €95 million a year. But according to Elisenda Anamani from the City Council, the costs associated with dealing with the tourists, so like street cleaning, security, transport, all of that stuff, costs the city €142 million a year. So you have to start asking whether economically having the city jammed with this many people is really worth it. The tourism tax is due to go up to €4 a person as part of efforts by the mayor, Jaume Colboni, to get these problems under control. And his administration is also trying to limit the number of cruise passengers who just visit for the day. That particular type of tourist doesn't pour that much money into the local economy because they're not even staying the night. They're just passing through really quickly. The city is also launching more crowd control policies at busy places like the Sagrada Familia. And they're trying to invest some of the money earned from the tourist tax directly into schools so that it feels more like tourism is actually benefiting normal people. But hostility to tourists, it runs pretty deep in Barcelona. This is far from the first time that anti-tourism protests have erupted in the city. Kat said that during the financial crisis especially, people really resented being run off their feet, working as, you know, waiters or whatever, serving German tourists and other tourists, all while the media portrayal of Spaniards in Europe at the time was like, oh, people from this country got themselves into this terrible financial mess because they're lazy. She also said that there have been lots of funny but derogatory words for tourists in Catalonia and Spain more broadly for years. One of her favorites is gambas, shrimp, meaning like people who are so sunburned that they've turned bright pink. I quite like that one.
That's mean again.
Well, it's a variant on the French calling the Brits hos beef because they're also a little bit pink.
Yes, it's okay so long as they don't shoot us with water pistols. Although I was thinking if it's really hot, then I wouldn't mind being shot with a water pistol.
It could be quite pleasant.
It could be. I also realised that in my city of Amsterdam, where I live, they tried...
And which famously hates tourists as well.
Yeah, it really does. They tried to ban Airbnb rentals in three neighborhoods in the city. They did that in 2020, and then a court actually ruled against that law, saying it was not allowed. So since 2023, you have been allowed to rent out in those neighborhoods, although with very, very strict limitations and a strict number of days. But I wonder whether this new rule in Barcelona will also get questioned in court.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I've struggled to find a city that is doing anything quite as radical in terms of its Airbnb policy as Barcelona is trying to do. Like you said, Amsterdam, but also some other cities in Europe, like Paris and Berlin, they've limited the number of nights that you can rent your own place out, which encourages people to rent their own homes while they're away on holiday rather than buying to let as short-term rentals. I quite like the policy in New York. They only let you rent out a spare room, which is kind of a throwback to the early Airbnb that you talked about. I think that's quite nice. You know, it forces you to stay with a local. I've had some really lovely experiences doing that because you get to talk to people who actually live in a place rather than staying in this weird detached tourism bubble. Amsterdam isn't even the only city that has brought in quite strict restrictions only to have to loosen them up a bit. Berlin was previously one of the cities that had one of the strictest policies. They banned rentals of entire homes in 2016. But they ended up loosening the policy a fair bit because it felt unworkable. And now they just have various other restrictions in place. So yeah, indeed, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in Barcelona now. Like if this policy is actually going to stick as long as 2029. I mean, as we know from this week, governments come, governments fall. That includes city administrations. But there'll be a lot of other cities around the world, I think, very, very interested to see if Barcelona genuinely is Airbnb free by 2029. And if it is, how much that actually helps local people.
Yeah, and before we stop talking about this, I just want to mention that hotels are also part of the problem. They're also taking up space that could be housing local residents. And I sometimes get a bit annoyed that all the focus is on Airbnb and that big hotels, often owned by multinational owners with profits going out of the country anyway, are just kind of given a free pass.
And it's kind of interesting because if you bring in one of these policies that restricts Airbnb, it forces people who want to visit the city into hotels. One of the main impacts of the New York restrictions so far seems to be a rise in hotel prices. So those people you mentioned are just earning quite a bit more money than they already were.
We've been making this podcast for 6.5 years now, and there is no way we would still be doing it without the support of a pretty amazing chunk of our listeners who voluntarily give us a bit of their money each month to keep us afloat. If you are enjoying the show and want us to keep making it, then please consider joining that gang of superstar supporters by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
And the gang has got pleasingly bigger this week. Not sure if we should interpret this as a positive reaction to you being away for 2 weeks, Dominic.
Yeah.
People seem to have loved you not being here. Joking, obviously, the Europeans would not be the same without you. But yes, we have some very generous new people to thank this week. And they are Mattia, Carol, Howard, Kelly, Emmy, Jan, and Anna, and also Antonio, Adam, and Raphael for increasing their donations. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you all so much. Please donate this week, otherwise I will really read it as people wanting me not to be on this show.
Well, just bring the robot back.
So it's time for our interview today. And to join me in interviewing today's very special guest, a certain someone by the name of Katie Lee, we're joined by producer Wojciech Oleksiak. Hi, Wojciech.
Hi.
Bonjour.
Nice you could join us today. I'm so glad we're going to be talking about the French election results today because A, the results are rather confusing, and B, I almost fell off my chair when I saw the headline results.
Do you know what you're talking about? The whole thing's very straightforward and obvious.
Oh, good. Well, you can clear everything up for us then. That's good. If you haven't heard anything of what happened in the second round of the French parliamentary elections that took place on Sunday, the far-right party of Marine Le Pen had been expected to come top, according to the polls, but in the end, her party didn't come top. They didn't even come second. They came third. Rather hodgepodge mixture of left and centre-left parties called the New Popular Front ended up coming top, with Macron's centrists coming in second. This all happened because there was a huge movement of tactical voting to keep the far right out of power, this so-called Republican Front, and it was seemingly more successful, I guess, than had been predicted. But that said, it isn't a clear set of results, and it's not clear what's going to happen now. So we have a lot to unpick today.
That's a very good summary. I don't even think I need to be here, frankly.
Well, I think you have. Can I make Katie blush a bit before we start asking questions?
Oh, be my guest.
So Katie has been explaining what is going on in France on our podcast WhatsApp group chat ever since Macron called the snap election in the wake of the explosive European Parliament results in France. She then did a super insightful interview for the New Paris podcast. And I listened carefully and immediately became a resident expert on French politics among my closest friends. And you know, I realized that sometimes when you're around someone really, really smart day in and day out, you kind of take it for granted. Then you have these moments when they appear on TV or another show and you're like, damn, like that's some smart analysis. So I couldn't think of a better person to explain how this election eventually played out.
Wojciech, you can't see me, but I am blushing.
No, but that's true.
I totally agree with him.
So go on then. What do you guys want to ask me?
Well, I wanted to start by asking you about the unexpected element of these results. These days, it seems to almost never happen that there's a surprise win for the left. So I was really taken aback when these results dropped at 8 p.m. on Sunday. Why do you think so many people, including the pollsters, didn't see this set of results coming?
Okay, so apologies for getting nerdy really, really quickly. But it all comes down to the election system that we use for parliamentary elections here in France. So like you said, Dominic, this was a two-round election, right? There was a first round on June the 30th. And in your local constituency, if a candidate gets more than 50% of the vote locally in that first round, they get elected and there's no second round. And that's what happened in my neighborhood. I live in a pretty left-wing neighborhood here in Paris. Our candidate, who was already the sitting MP, she got more than 50% in the first round. So she got re-elected straight away and my neighbors and I didn't get to vote again last Sunday. But that was actually quite a rare situation. There's 577 constituencies in the French Parliament. 501 of them were still to play for on Sunday in this second round of the election. Mm. Now, normally, there would just be two candidates left on the ballot in round two. It's like a runoff. But, and here's where things get complicated, in a constituency where at least three of the candidates got at least 12.5% of registered voters to vote for them, you can have a three-way runoff. And there was really, really unusually high turnout in these elections because the stakes were really high. So there were quite a lot of constituencies that had these three-way races, more than 300 of them, when normally it's like eight or less. And that created a dilemma for left-wing and centrist parties ahead of the second round. They really wanted to block the far right. And, you know, having two different options for people to vote for who weren't the far right, that would limit the chance of keeping the far-right politician from winning that seat. Mm. So as soon as the first round results came in, the Front Populaire, this left-wing alliance, they immediately said after the first round, you know, any constituency where we're placed third, we're going to withdraw. So the only option is going to be a far-right candidate versus a non-far-right candidate. And Macron's liberals mostly did the same. They were a little bit more reticent to do it, which has been seen as not very sporting by a lot of people. But in the end, most of these three-way races ended up becoming two-way races with just one far-right candidate and either a left-wing or a centrist candidate. Now, the reason that we didn't see these overall results coming with the left-wing alliance coming top was because there was so much strategic voting happening at a super local level that it was like incredibly difficult to predict how the second round was going to turn out. So I'll give you an example. Say that you are like a mildly center-right person in a constituency where your choice was either the far right or a very, very left-wing candidate. What are you going to do? You detest Marine Le Pen, but you're also really uncomfortable with the idea of a hard left government in France. Are you just going to like hold your nose and vote for this super leftist? Or do you maybe stay away from the election in general? These kinds of personal dilemmas were playing out on an individual constituency level across the country on Sunday. And the opinion polls just couldn't capture that level of like hugely unpredictable individual decision making.
Hmm. And it seems like more people went and held their nose and did vote for a politician they wouldn't necessarily want to vote for in order to keep out the hard right.
Yeah, and that was the other thing that was really hard to predict, the turnout. So quite a few of the people who were really pissed off with the Macron government and think that this country is, you know, going to the dogs, they had voted in the first round to express their anger. And then maybe because they're not very engaged in politics, it seems that they turned up in smaller numbers on Sunday. And the people who really wanted to block them, they did make the effort to turn up. This ended up being a really high turnout election. 66.7% of the electorate voted, which is the highest, I think, in a second round election since 1997. But yeah, I mean, even if the results themselves are very complicated and messy, they do show pretty clearly that a majority of this country, at least the majority who voted, do not want the far right to govern.
I have to admit, I really love the idea of holding your nose and voting. It feels like that's something we do a lot in Europe, especially recently. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now the threat of Le Pen and Jordan Bardella ruling France is sort of over. So what are the scenarios that could now happen?
You know, it's funny. I had kind of two types of friends who I was WhatsApping with on Sunday night. The first kind were like, yay, ecstatic relief. They're the kind of people that were these huge celebrations in the street on Sunday night, cheering the fact that the far right are not going to be in government. The second type of friend is the pessimist who was immediately like, but France is now ungovernable. Mm-hmm. Because the split between the three main blocs, left, liberal and far right, is really pretty equal. So we're probably going to have some kind of coalition if we want to have a semi-functioning government. And there's actually a fun coalition builder on the news website Le Grand Continent that you can use to try and build a workable coalition and probably give yourself a headache.
Your idea of fun is getting very twisted.
I've been making this podcast for too long, apparently. But there have been various different suggestions in recent days for the government that we might end up with. Maybe some kind of minority government led by one of these blocs, but that wouldn't be very stable at all. More probably, we're going to see eventually some kind of cooperation between the liberals and the left, or at least parts of those blocs. Right now, a big broad coalition between the Front Populaire and the liberals, that doesn't look very likely because the liberals hate the far left with a passion. So the likelihood is swinging slightly towards maybe some combo of the liberals and the more kind of moderate center-left. But, you know, that would involve splitting this left-wing coalition that formed for these elections. And that split could be really, really ugly and there could be lots of accusations of backstabbing. So I don't know what government we're going to have is the answer.
One of the people that these centrists seem to really hate is this guy, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who's been kind of compared to Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders as this kind of left-wing boomer. Could you tell us a bit about who he is? He seems to be like quite hated by Macron and Macronistas.
Yeah, he's definitely a pretty iconic figure. He's been like a very prominent figure on the left for a very, very long time here in France. He's a repeat presidential candidate, a kind of left-wing firebrand. And I think actually the Bernie Sanders / Jeremy Corbyn comparison is actually quite a good one because he does have a kind of cult-like status amongst certain young people, despite being, as you say, a boomer. You might have seen, I think it was last week, this photo of him standing at Gay Pride here in Paris, surrounded by topless men.
I did.
And wearing his kind of trademark curmudgeonly deadpan expression. He is quite funny. But he's also extremely divisive. So a bit like Labour under Corbyn in the UK, there have been a lot of accusations of his party tolerating anti-Semitism. It's a party that certainly has been very vocally pro-Palestinian. He also has a history of ambiguous positions on Syria and also blaming NATO for the war in Ukraine, both positions that have had to be sort of rolled back on in recent years. So the idea of him being prime minister is just complete anathema for the Macronist camp, which leaves us with a bunch of other figures who might want to be prime minister. The general assumption right now is that we will probably have a prime minister from the leftist bloc. That makes sense because they came top, right? Mm-hmm. So if it isn't going to be Mélenchon, even though he's the kind of most iconic senior figure in that camp, who might it be? There's another guy from his party, Manuel Bompard, whose name has been suggested because he's a bit more cooperative than Mélenchon. And actually, the socialists are also going to argue that even though they did slightly less well within this left-wing bloc than Mélenchon's party, they would maybe be a better bridge with the liberals because they're more centrist. So that's also an idea that's being kicked around at the moment. And there's a couple of people who are being suggested as possible socialist prime ministers. One of them is Raphael Glucksmann. He's the guy who led the French socialists to a pretty decent showing just now in the European elections. And there's also the actual boss of the socialists, who's a guy called Olivier Faure. who doesn't really get much of the limelight, but he's sort of quietly, widely liked, I think, and seen as quite calm and reasonable. Oh, also, random fact, he's half Vietnamese like me. So on a personal level, it'd be very exciting for me to see a half Vietnamese prime minister.
Cool.
Even though that's not a very good reason for wanting someone to be prime minister. One final person that I wanted to flag up as a possible prime minister is someone who was a bit of a star of this very short election campaign, and that is the French Green leader, Marine Tondelier. She's always seen in this trademark green jacket, a jacket which has become so iconic that it actually now has its own Twitter account. And she made some really punchy, sometimes quite moving TV appearances during the campaign. She's a really, really good talker. So she's also in the mix.
Are there any recent historical precedents for this kind of complicated coalition building in the French parliament?
Yeah, we don't actually have a formal coalition building tradition here in the same way as they do in quite a lot of European countries, which is why people think that it might take a very, very long time forming a government. Like, we're just not used to making political compromises here in France across parties. We do have a couple of traditions that look a bit like coalitions. So since 2022, we've had a minority government, which has been led by Macron's party, but without him having a majority in parliament. And that government has been sort of messily getting laws passed on a case-by-case basis with support from other parties, or alternatively, quite often just forcing laws through by presidential decree, which has been super unpopular because it's seen as very undemocratic. We also have this tradition, this other tradition called cohabitation, which is where you have a president from one party forced to live with a prime minister and government from another party. Hmm. That has happened three times since the 80s. But each time, it was a situation where the left or the right had a clear majority in parliament. So the situation was more clear-cut. I mean, it's really interesting, this election, because the voting system that we use for parliamentary elections in France usually delivers much clearer outcomes than this. So we're really in uncharted territory. And this time, it looks like one of the most probable outcomes is some kind of combination of cohabitation and a coalition, which would be a really new era of collaborative politics. And I'm daring to think that it might be a good thing if it doesn't turn out to be a total disaster, which is also very possible.
That's quite a puzzle. And now turning into the devil's advocate for a moment, a part of me thinks that the system really played against the chances of Rassemblement National to win it all. And I'm wondering, how do you look at it? Did a mechanism shielding democracy against a not-so-democratic party work? Or is it a sign that the system is too rigid for new forces to take over and change politics in a more decisive manner?
Interesting question. I mean, you could argue that this system has produced a new force because we now have this left alliance that is the top bloc in parliament. And that is a situation that seemed really impossible just a few months ago, even. And that was forced by the situation, right? The electoral situation forced them to come together. And that is why we're going to end up with a probably left-leaning government of some kind. But it's a really weird situation. I mean, once my initial relief had faded, like a lot of people, that we are not going to have a government led by the far right, I started feeling really anxious about how the average voter who voted for Le Pen is going to feel about these results. They're going to feel like they were cheated, even though what happened was a legitimate exercise of people power and people did exactly what was in the rules. They're not going to see it that way. They're going to feel like people gamed the system once again to keep them out of power. And I'm not saying that because I feel sorry for them, but the fact is that there's quite a lot of people in this country and generally Western democracies who don't feel listened to. And this is going to be yet another result that makes them feel like their voice doesn't get heard. So I'm a little uneasy about it.
But on the other hand, the other fact is that there wasn't anything like a majority of people that wanted the far right to come into power. So that's quite right that they don't.
Yeah, and I think it's something that often gets forgotten. You know, in general, their support level has been about a third, maybe a little bit more. And I think the way that we talk about the far right threat, it often sounds like it's more than 50%. Now, having like a third of the electorate that wants to vote for this party is something that is still quite disturbing. But it's not the same as more than half. And I think we kind of forget that sometimes.
Yeah, I've seen quite a lot of people on social media saying that the media is too obsessed with the far right in Europe. Everything's being framed around their threat of their rise, and that actually election results like these in France show that they're not as big or popular as the media make them out to be. I don't know if I agree with that analysis because actually, sorry, I'm just answering the question myself. Is that okay?
That's fine.
I don't know if I agree with that analysis in the end, because it seems to me, at least from where I am, that one of the reasons why turnout was so high in France was because of all this media attention about the threat of the far right.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't want to be in favor of like super depressing apocalyptic news coverage. But I do think that if voters hadn't really got this message communicated to them very, very strongly that the stakes in this election were really, really high, I don't think they would have turned out on Sunday the numbers that they did.
This is all happening with the Olympics about to kick off in a few weeks in Paris. And I've also heard quite a lot of arguments that there needs to be a caretaker government, possibly with the current prime minister staying in place, at least until the Olympics are over. And I have to say, I found that a bit weird. Like, how much does a government have to actually act during the Olympics? It's a sports competition.
Well,
it's not a political event. Would it really be a problem if the coalition negotiations were going on at the same time?
Oh, I think the coalition negotiations probably are going to go on at the same time. I think you're looking at this from the perspective of the Netherlands, which is a country that actually has an organized way of doing coalition talks. Like here, it's going to be chaos. And I strongly suspect that like on the sidelines of the handball, there's going to be like a socialist prime minister muttering to someone from Macron's camp, like, what if you get the foreign ministry and we get the finance ministry and stuff like that? I mean, I'm not really that surprised that Macron has asked the current child prime minister, Gabriel Attal, who's 35 and sometimes described as the intern in a rather derogatory fashion. I'm not surprised that he's asked him to stay on for now. I mean, you say it's like just a sports competition, Dominic, which surprises me because you're our sports correspondent, in fact. But like, there's like 3 million people coming to our city for this. The whole world is going to be watching. And it's not a good look if we're like, yeah, we just don't really have a government during this period. Also, I mean, God forbid something terrible like a terrorist attack happens during the games. Wouldn't you want a government in place for that?
Of course, there needs to be like an acting government, you're right. And I think you're right that I'm looking at it from the Dutch perspective where we're used to like waiting a year or even longer for the government to actually find a way to form.
I mean, that is a very strong possibility here as well. We'll have to see.
By the way, 3 million people in Paris, I think you should shoot them with water cannons or water pistols.
No.
Anyway.
They probably love it.
I'm really curious, and I have to ask you about this. How do you think Macron will be feeling after these results and about his gamble to call these elections?
Yeah, there were some quite funny memes going around of Macron like flexing his muscles. The winner! Knowing Macron, he will probably be congratulating himself and thinking, the genius strikes again. There have been some takes floating around this week saying like, this was a well-played strategic choice. Macron knew what he was doing. I don't think that's true. I'm in the kind of slightly unusual camp that thinks that Macron didn't really have much choice but to call these elections because they were going to be forced upon him soon anyway. Mm. And at least this way, it was at his initiative. So I do think he will be relieved. Certainly, it could have been a lot worse, right?
Oh, yeah.
He could have been forced to work with the far-right prime minister. I mean, given how close it has felt at times to utter disaster over the last few weeks, I hope he will be a little bit humbled by this experience, but I'm not sure that that's possible. I mean, humble is not a word that's often used to describe Emmanuel Macron.
Which of the two early election gambles from European leaders do you think turned out to be more disastrous for the people who called them? Rishi Sunak in calling the early election in the UK or Emmanuel Macron calling the early election in France?
Oh, Sunak's had a worse week. No contest.
Yeah.
I mean, Macron's had a messy week, but a way better one than it could have been, with really quite a decent chunk of the parliament still under his control. So his gamble has ultimately paid off-ish. I mean, having said that, ask me again in like 6 months or a year when we still don't have a government and the entire country has descended into chaos, and I may reassess my opinion on that.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us today, Katie.
You're welcome.
Katie is great on Twitter when she decides to grace us with her presence. You can follow her at KJA Lee.
I'm not there. Don't tell people that. I hate Twitter.
Or you can hear her speaking each week on a podcast called The Europeans.
Right, that's quite enough talking from me. It's time to head to the Inspiration Station. And I'm going to ask you, Dominic, what have you been enjoying while you've been away?
Well, I've just been on holiday in Scotland, and whilst I was away, we drove for many hours through the incredible landscapes of the Scottish Highlands. Everyone should go. It's really so beautiful. And being the good millennials that we are, we occasionally put on a podcast to accompany our drive. Mm-hmm. I actually listened to two episodes of this show.
This show? Our show?
Yeah, but that's not what I'm going to be recommending, because that would be strange. For my cultural recommendation today, I'm going to recommend another podcast that also touched on the topic of AI. It is an episode of the BBC's documentary podcast called Germany's AI Detectives. Ooh. It tells the story of some German podcasters using an AI search engine to track down a fugitive who'd been on the run for more than 30 years. Mm. The fugitive in question has now been arrested, and the German police say that it wasn't directly thanks to the podcast, but it did happen like straight after the podcast came out. So it's a bit weird. Mm. It's a really fascinating story about the arrest of this woman, Daniela Kletter, who was a member of the left-wing militant Red Army faction, who were active in Germany between the 70s and the 90s. Yeah. So it's about her story, about how the podcast has worked out where she was, and also about the crimes of the Red Army faction more broadly.
Yeah, I remember her arrest. I had no idea there was an AI element to it.
Well, there potentially wasn't.
Okay.
The police claim there wasn't, but then it's a real coincidence that these podcasters revealed their work just before she was arrested. Anyway, I'm sure you will have all heard about this case if you live in Germany, but if you don't know about it, then this episode is a great thing to put in your ears whilst driving through Scottish Highlands or commuting to work. Only if you've run out of episodes of The Europeans, of course.
Of course.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, you said it would be weird for you to recommend this podcast, but I've been very busy, so I'm going to cheat this week and indeed recommend The Europeans.
Awkward.
But there's a good reason for it. It's because we've got a beautiful new YouTube channel, courtesy of Wojciech. He's been working very hard on making it look nice for all of you. On our new YouTube page, you can find quite a lot of our recent episodes, audio only, but also a bunch of the visual podcasts that we've made with our friends at Are We Europe over the past few years. So if you're looking for a new place to explore the pod, or maybe a link to share with that friend who quote unquote doesn't do podcasts, you should check it out. It's at youtube.com/Europeans podcast.
Okay, my happy ending this week is honestly not that European, but it is a tiny bit European because it is a piece of research by a team who are partly based at University College Cork in Ireland.
I'll take it.
And the research is something that could affect a category of people that I imagine is almost every one of our European listeners: chocolate lovers.
Oh, of course.
Scientists have discovered three new species of cacao plant in the rainforests of South America, plants that are closely related to Theobroma cacao, the tree that bears cacao beans and makes our beloved chocolate. And this is good news because we need to find more climate-resilient cacao trees. Mm. One of the scientists in Ireland involved in the research, Dr. Richardson, said the following about the discovery. Cacao prices have trebled in recent months due to low production as a result of a prolonged period of drought in West Africa, which is the area of greatest production. The discovery of new species, in addition to those already known, expands the genetic resources that are available to us that might allow us to produce drought-tolerant or disease-resistant cacao trees. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly important, not only for us chocolate lovers, but also a very important discovery for farmers of cacao who are struggling with how the changing climate is affecting their crop. Long live chocolate.
I have a really important question.
Yeah?
Do we know what it tastes like yet?
No, I don't think we know that yet. I don't think it was included in the study.
Dr. Richardson. Yeah,
come on, Dr. Richardson.
Get back to work. That's all we've got time for this week. It's nice to have you back, Dominic Kramer.
Nice to be back, Katie Lee. We've got a very special episode landing next Thursday from Hungary.
Yeah.
In the meantime, you can check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon?
Yeah.
Or Threads?
Sort of, yes.
or come chat to us at the private Patreon group on Facebook, if you're a member.
It's a very nice place. We'll see you in the Facebook group, everyone.
This week's episode was produced by Katie Lee and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Toodaloo.
See you next week, everyone.